This is Where We Live. From Connecticut Public Radio, I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Coming up, we reflect on the fight for marriage equality in Connecticut. On this day, 10 years ago, the state became the second in the country to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. We'll hear from one of the Connecticut couples who signed on as plaintiffs in the landmark case. We'll also talk with a longtime advocate for LGBTQ rights, Anne Stanback, about the issues she and others are continuing to fight for today. First, Veterans Day this year fell on Sunday, marking 100 years since the armistice was signed to end World War I. Later, November 11th will be recognized as a federal holiday to honor the American men and women who serve in the U.S. military. Sometimes stories that highlight the contributions of veterans are unknown because they aren't passed down from one generation to next. That's what happened to a Hartford, Connecticut man named David McGee. Connecticut Public Radio reporter David DeRoche picks up the story. He joins me now in studio. David, welcome back to the show.
So happy to be here, Lucy.
Tell us about this Hartford man again, David McGee, and how he was able to figure out the story of his grandfather.
Sure. So David called, you know, we have a newsroom line, and David called the newsroom line, which we all take turns answering, and I just happened to answer it. And as he starts telling me the story, I was like, wow. And it's very rare that somebody calls with this just really compelling story. And so I was just really sucked into it. And David has this amazing story. So he was really close to his grandmother. He was an only child, really close to his grandmother growing up. And she kept this suitcase under her bed. And she kept it wherever she went, wherever she lived, she kept it under her bed. And she really didn't share the contents with anybody. Like, her children didn't know what was in it. Nobody knew what was in it other than her. And she never talked about her husband, or her first husband, who died in World War II. So David had no idea who his grandfather was. He had no idea what was in the suitcase, but he knew the suitcase was special because he had seen his grandmother go into the suitcase, and he saw pictures, and he said, well, what was that? And she said, well, those are my parents, and she never made any other comments about it. So he knew that the suitcase was special, and so when she died, he really wanted that suitcase, and so he inherited the suitcase, but it took him over a decade before he could open it up. He wanted to get emotionally prepared to do it because he was really close with his grandmother. And he started developing an interest in genealogy, and he realized, you know, hey, there's got to be some really interesting stuff in the suitcase. And so eventually he was able to open it up, and that's when this whole story just sort of takes off.
You were able to chat with David McGee in his home, and he actually showed you this suitcase from his deceased grandmother. Let's hear a clip of what he told you about it.
It has that musty smell to it. She had it for many, many years. This suitcase was started with documents that were sent to her from the military, as you can see, and it continued to grow until the date of her death.
So he mentioned documents, David DeRoche. What exactly was in that suitcase?
So, you know, he opens it in front of me, and it really was just like a magical moment. You know, you see just these old documents. They're falling apart. They're fraying at the edges. They're browning. You know, he has original letters that his grandfather had written to his wife. And, you know, at the top of the letter, it says, from somewhere in Germany. He didn't even know where he was. But David points out that, you know, in this letter, you know, he's you know, going through Germany. He was in an ordnance division. So what they did was they handled spent munitions. They would go into the battlefield after a battle, and they'd find spent munitions or things that were still live, and they'd gather them, and they would either dispose of them or store them. And so, you know, it was a really dangerous environment, obviously. But in this letter, you don't get a sense of any of that. You know, he's asking about his kids. A child was born when he was overseas. So there's this letter. There's Western Union telegrams announcing the birth of his child. There are trekking maps that he drew. He drew maps of his trek through Germany, and there are locations on the map that note where they expected bombs to be. And if you look at the map and his hand-drawn map and you compare it to an actual map, I mean, the scale is amazing. Like, he had this really amazing ability to you know, map things for, and he had this uncanny ability also to do a variety of different things. Like, his handwriting was impeccable. His drawing was excellent. And what was interesting was in those times the military were segregated. But he served in an African-American unit, but David has evidence to show that he was actually pulled out of that unit to serve with some white soldiers because he was adept at a lot of different things. And so that was typically something that happened back then. So he could have been like one of the forerunners of desegregating the military, which is kind of interesting.
In that suitcase, he also discovered that his grandfather, where did he die?
He discovered that his grandfather died in an explosion in June of 1945. But he didn't know where his grandfather was buried. His grandmother had told him that he was buried in a local cemetery, but when David went to that cemetery, he didn't find any record of him. So eventually, as he's going through the suitcase, you know, he has there's all this information about what his grandfather had done, and you know, all these information about his service, but he couldn't find where he was buried. And so that's when he turned to the internet, and that's when things got even more interesting.
You're hearing David DeRoche, a reporter for Connecticut Public Radio here on Where We Live, as we talk about a story that David produced for Veterans Day, this journey that a Hartford, Connecticut man took to find out the story of his grandfather who served in World War II. His grandfather was Sergeant Willie Williams?
Correct.
So you said he went to the internet, and how did he figure out more about his grandfather's service in the Netherlands?
So he essentially just typed in his grandfather's name. And, you know, the first thing most of us do when we go to the internet to learn about somebody, he just typed in his grandfather's name. And eventually he found this website called Black Liberators of the Netherlands. And it was started by a woman named Mika Kierkels in the Netherlands in 2009. And she had come across she's a historian, and she had learned that there were 172 black American soldiers buried in the Netherlands. Now, there are 8,301 American graves in the cemetery in the Netherlands, but she was able to figure out that there's a code that the military would use to indicate the soldier's race. And so she learned that there are 172 black soldiers buried there, and so she knew that there was this history of segregated military, and she also knew that there's this also history of sort of or lost history, right? The things that we don't want to remember because we're ashamed of the history, and black soldiers' service is a big part of that. Most of us have heard of the Tuskegee Airmen, but many of us have not heard about the black soldiers who built the Lido Road or the Red Ball Express. So there are all these really, really cool stories of history involving African-American soldiers that have sort of been lost. And so Mika Kierkel's goal from the Netherlands is to uncover their stories and bring those stories to the world. So when David found her website, through his name, through his grandfather's name, he got really excited. He's like, there's my grandfather. He's buried in the Netherlands. And so he made that connection. And then, you know, he's been to the Netherlands. And it's just like the whole story is just – it's super heartwarming and awesome to go on the journey with him as he's telling me the story. It was really awesome and a real treat for me.
So literally an American man who lives in Hartford, Connecticut, was able to find out more about his grandfather who served in World War II through a Dutch historian. Why is that information not readily available here in this country, David?
So it's interesting. So Mika's explanation is that, and I've looked a little bit into it, and it seems to make some sense, is that the history of African Americans in the military service in those times was sort of – it wasn't necessarily suppressed, but the veterans organizations that existed back then were segregated, like the VFW, the American Legion. They didn't allow black members. Now, black members could start their own posts, but they didn't have the sort of legacy of information and knowledge that they would keep about the soldiers. So because of the segregated nature of the military and the segregated nature of the veterans organizations, a lot of that history has sort of been lost. But David's grandmother's suitcase is sort of this treasure trove of information about one soldier. And it doesn't – you know, might provide some insight into, you know, what life was like for most soldiers, but it's really just a specific insight into David McGee's grandfather's life. And so it really is this sort of bridge between all this history that's been lost, and now we have this treasure trove of information about one guy. And so it is this sort of bridge that's sort of connecting worlds that we might have been lost to this one man who has this really amazing story.
You were able to speak with Dutch historian Mika Kierkels for the story you did for National Public Radio. What did she tell you about, again, the fact that you had these segregated units, these African Americans serving in World War II, but the images of them largely aren't readily available? We don't think about them when we think about World War II.
Right. So, you know, she has done a lot of work gathering information. She's only been able to actually get information on a couple of the soldiers buried there, maybe like five or six soldiers. Again, because of how history has sort of was sort of separated out a lot of what those soldiers did. But through this project, you know, she's aiming to reach out to more people. She wants to find more information about these soldiers. She only has basic information, biographical information about these five or about the 172 black soldiers buried there. So she doesn't have like information about, you know, where they're, she knows where they're from, but no information about their story. She doesn't know, like, you know, what they were like, you know, where their what their families were like, what their life was like here in the United States. So she's slowly figuring that stuff out, and people like David, I think, are like a gold mine of information for historians.
And here's an interview, part of the interview that you did. Here's a clip from that interview with Dutch historian Mieke Kierkels.
White Americans were segregated from the black Americans, who also, there were 900,000 in Europe. I mean, why is it not in history books?
So then this is an outsider's view of why we don't know more about African Americans who served this country. But you also talked about that with David McGee, whose grandfather, this is the story we're tracing today here on Where We Live. And he told you, it's not as surprising for him. Let's hear what he told you.
You have to really understand the African American experience to know that part of history is missing. And that's why this project is so important to me, because it's now being told.
The story doesn't end with just this connection via the internet. David McGee actually traveled to the Netherlands?
Yeah, so this is where it really becomes very heartwarming. So him and his wife decided to go to the Netherlands on Memorial Day a couple years ago. And they realized that he realized that his grandfather's grave was actually adopted by a Dutch couple. And every single grave in the Netherlands is adopted by a Dutch couple. There's actually a waiting list of people who want to adopt a grave. And basically what that means is, on special occasions, the families, the adoptees, will go to the graves, they'll lay flowers, they take care of it, they just make sure it's kept up. But most of the people who have adopted graves in the Netherlands had no idea if they had adopted a white soldier's grave or a black soldier's grave. And once they found out, a lot of them didn't care, but they were just very interested to know that, you know, this was sort of this reality. And so Mieke is sort of, you know, bringing this to the forefront. And it's, in David's case, his grandfather's grave is tended to by this one couple. And when they die, they'll give it to their daughter to take care of. And he was just really captivated by this. And when he went to their home, he actually saw a photograph of his grandfather framed among the photographs of this family. And so he immediately felt like it was family. And the way he describes that is just really heartwarming.
We have that clip of David McGee talking about that moment.
There's so many emotions that you just can't, that goes through you at one time, that it's very difficult to put into words. And, you know, it's a big world out there, but it's a small world. And to know that, you know, Jan and Josh Meets have been tending to his grave, and knowing that others are being tended to the same way it's hard to put into words.
So we hear David McGee telling you again about this Dutch couple, Jan and Josh Meets, is that how you say it?
Smeets, yeah.
Smeets. That they're the ones that adopted his grandfather's grave. Why are people in the Netherlands so invested in keeping up these graves of these American soldiers?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I was talking with Carmen Baskoff, our producer, and we talked about how, you know, a lot of World War II memories are a little bit removed from us here in the United States because, you know, the wars were not fought on our land. But in the Netherlands, you know, that was actually occupied by Germany for some time. And when it was liberated, you know, it was a big deal for the Netherlands. And they want to remember that sacrifice. So when the Americans were among the liberating force that came through the Netherlands, and a lot of them obviously died in that liberation process, you know, they really hold on to that. And it's a really special thing. You know, when we had somebody in the Netherlands with Mieke to record interviews with her. And they randomly came across this couple, and the couple was talking about the sacrifice of the Americans. And this was just a random day. They just happened to be there. So they're very connected to the service that we did over there. And you can see it. And they just have this real deep connection to the soldiers who served over there.
David McGee again of Hartford, Connecticut, learning more about his grandfather who served in World War II, Sergeant Willie Williams. Tell us more about the fact that now that he knows about his grandfather, how he's trying to dig into more information about his service and the service of other African Americans.
Yeah, you know, Lucy, the story was there was so much treasure, and it was kind of like coming across treasure in a remote space in a part of the world, and knowing you can only take back 10% of this treasure. That was kind of like how I was trying to tell the story. David has so many pieces of treasure in his story. And one of them that I was not able to talk about, but is this idea that his grandfather died actually after the peace treaty was signed by Germany, but we were still at war with Japan. So he's trying to figure out what happened. There was an explosion. It was listed as an accident, but he says there was sniper fire happening at the time. So he's curious to know if it actually was an engagement with the enemy incident, in which case his grandfather should be awarded a Purple Heart. So he's trying to figure that out. So he's still on this journey to try to uncover more. And he has all this information in the suitcase, but he still seems to want more information. And so his journey is actually, ongoing.
Does David McGee, did he talk to you about, after the war, when many of these African Americans that served came back to a country that still saw them as second-class citizens?
Right, and that was a big thing that this project is hoping to uncover and that David is trying to learn more about and express, is that, African American soldiers were said to be fighting two wars, the war against fascism abroad and the war against segregation and racism here. And that was a big deal. And through this project, they're hoping to uncover more of that struggle and hope to educate people. And so we understand what that actually was like for the African-American soldiers who did so much in that war. Mika pointed out 900,000 served and tens of thousands were killed or injured. And so bringing that history to the forefront is super important for David and for Mika Kirkles.
David DeRoche is a reporter for Connecticut Public Radio. David, thank you for picking up that call in the newsroom to uncover the story of David McGee in Hartford. You can go to our website, WMPR.org/where we live, to see a video of David's interview with, again, David McGee, talking about his grandfather, Sergeant Willie Williams, who served in World War II. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, November 12th is an important date in the fight for marriage equality. We're going to talk more about the movement that led to Connecticut legalizing same-sex marriage after the break. And you can join us too, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today, gay marriage is a legal right nationwide after a 2015 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that overturned state bans on same-sex marriage. Yet the movement for marriage rights took years to accomplish. On this day, 10 years ago, Connecticut was the second state in the United States to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Coming up, we'll hear from one of the plaintiff couples in the lawsuit that helped bring marriage equality to Connecticut. Janet Peck and Carol Conklin are Colchester residents who will celebrate their 10-year anniversary this coming January. We're going to talk with them in a few minutes. Now, if you're in a same-sex relationship, what does this date, November 12th, mean to you? You can join us, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. First, it was the Love Makes a Family nonprofit organization that advocated strongly for gay marriage in Connecticut. Ann Stanback led the organization, which disbanded in 2009 after its goal was realized in our state. Ann joins me now in studio. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Lucy.
I should mention Ann has been working as an activist for more than 30 years with a long history here in Connecticut. But I remember meeting you as a new reporter when you were founding executive director of Love Makes a Family. Tell us about how you got involved with that organization and when did marriage equality become the goal?
I got involved probably because I had been very involved in the fight for our non-discrimination law that passed back in 1991. And my partner, now wife, Charlotte, and I, I think we always thought we would love to get married in the early days, 35 years ago. I don't think that we saw it on the horizon. But as states like Hawaii began to move cases through their court system, we started thinking this was a reality. And there were several of us who thought, you know, Connecticut is a perfect place to make this a reality. So we really jumped in with both feet.
You referenced that 1991 gay rights statute that prohibited discrimination against LGBTQ individuals in the state.
Actually, it was just on the basis of sexual orientation. It took years later to get gender identity, but that was in housing, employment, public accommodations.
And then later, you worked towards adoption rights for same-sex couples?
That's right. In 1999, our state Supreme Court ruled against a lesbian couple who was trying to get second parent adoption for the child that they were both raising together. And they ruled against her, but in essence said, you know, this is something the legislature needs to fix. Love Makes a Family came together at that point as an informal coalition to work on adoption. And within 2 years, we were able to pass that law. And folks felt like we should turn our attention to marriage once adoption was a reality. Mm-hmm. And we did that for the next 9 years.
Now, civil unions came before actual marriage equality in 2005. What did that mean for the gay and lesbian community in Connecticut? And just talk a little bit about the grassroots effort that came around that.
Yeah, one of the things that we did both in the fight for the non-discrimination law and then with adoption and even more with marriage was really to reach out around the state and get people telling their stories, getting same-sex couples telling their stories, but also getting allies, supporting organizations, people of faith to talk about why this was important. Civil unions was a marital status that was invented in the state of Vermont. It did come with all the state rights and protections of marriage, and in that way, it was an important step. But for Love Makes a Family and many of our supporters, it was also sort of a badge of inequality because it did not come with the word marriage, with the respect and dignity and equality that marriage was all about. So It was a step in the process, but we made very clear that unlike what some legislators, I think, hoped for, you know, that wasn't going to end the conversation on marriage, and we kept pushing once civil union was the law.
Massachusetts was the first state that allowed same-sex marriage. So when that happened, was that really the catalyst to really get it moving here in Connecticut to try to get that law here as well?
We had started our campaign before marriage had happened in Massachusetts. So I think a number of New England states began that work. But certainly after marriage became a reality in Massachusetts, I think that it was even clearer that civil union was not enough.
This is Where We Live. You're hearing Ann Stanback here on the show. She was founding executive director of Love Makes a Family. This was the lead organization in the campaign for marriage equality in the state of Connecticut. 10 years ago today, marriage license began to be given out to gay and lesbian couples who wanted to be married. One of those couples that became one of the face behind this movement also join us in studio, Janet Peck and Carol Conklin, and they were one of the plaintiff couples in Connecticut. Its marriage equality case. I want to welcome Janet and Carolyn to our show. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
So I'll start with you, Janet. Tell us how the two of you met.
Oh, gosh, that was so long ago. 43 years ago. We actually had met before that. We were in high school together, and that's when we first met each other, but went on to do different things. And I think when we both came back from college, we kind of got reacquainted at a dinner party. Of mutual friends, and we sat down together next to each other and started talking. And I always say we haven't stopped talking since, or at least I haven't. I talk more than Carol. And we've been together ever since. That's kind of what began our relationship.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, when we heard Anne kind of walking us through the different steps on the way to marriage equality in Connecticut, when did the two of you get involved with this campaign?
We actually became members of Love Makes a Family first. weren't quite as active right in the beginning. But when we heard of that, of Love Makes a Family being formed, we started paying attention. But when we really got involved was when we became plaintiffs. And when the Massachusetts case happened, that's when I started thinking that was the best way to and the quickest way to get marriage here in Connecticut. And I was correct. That was the quickest way. And that's when we really started getting involved. And as a plaintiff, we would not just be telling our case or making our case to the courts, but also interfacing with the media, telling our story to the media and to the people in Connecticut. And after that, you know, sometimes in a court case, there's a lot of time where you're not doing much of anything. You're waiting for the decisions to come down. We also became speakers in Love Makes a Family, which gave us access to speaking in a wide range of places so that we could help people to understand why it is that marriage was so important to us.
Oh, Carol, can I ask, was it difficult to be one of the faces in this fight for marriage equality?
I don't think it was difficult. I'm pretty shy, so it was, you know, something I had to think about, but I thought it was really important that we do it, so I agreed.
Were there, I'll go back to you, Janet, were there friends or family that were concerned about you being in the public eye like this?
I don't think so. I think they were all pretty proud of us more than anything, and they thought that we would be a good representation telling our stories. We've always had support from our families from almost our entire relationship, so I think they were just overall very supportive of us.
Mm. You mentioned having that support from friends and family, but that's not the case for everyone.
No, it is not.
Can you talk about what it meant for your friends who were gay or lesbian, this idea that, you know, maybe one day they'd be able to legally marry? It might not have been something they thought about as they were growing up, but they'd have that right.
I think it's interesting. I think the reactions were across the board. I think there were people who were very, very excited about it. And some people sort of had to think about it a little bit because they'd never had to think about it before. You know, they'd been together for a long time, and that's the way they were living. And so I think, you know, some people maybe hesitated, but it was interesting as soon as we got the right to marry, many of them changed their minds, and I think most of all our friends are married now and are happily married.
You're hearing Janet Peck. She's here with her wife, Carol Conklin. They were plaintiffs in Connecticut's marriage equality case on Where We Live. We're reflecting back 10 years ago today when that right became a reality. If you're one of those same-sex couples waiting for that moment in 2008, we want to hear from you, too, at the number 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. John's calling from Killing Leap. John, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So tell us about November 12, 2008, what it meant for you.
Well, Gino, I actually grew up in Georgia, and so I remember watching the headlines from afar, wishing that this could actually happen in my own home state. I didn't move to Connecticut until 2012 to take a job, and one of the things that pulled me up here was the potential to marry the person I loved without having to fight for it in quite the same way, and I'm so grateful for those who fought that fight on my behalf before I even thought about moving to Connecticut. Thank you, thank you, thank you for filing the lawsuit, for advocating for people like me and for themselves, of course, to make this kind of difference and change in our world.
John, could you tell us when you and your husband were married?
We were married in December of 2014. We are actually both pastors. I'm at Westfield Church in Killingly, Connecticut. He is at Thompson Congregational United Church of Christ in Thompson, Connecticut. He had just moved up here, and we decided to get married, and we got married in my very own church with my entire congregation present, and it was such a joyful day, such a celebration.
Well, thank you, John, for calling in here on Where We Live. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Anne, you were giving a thumbs up when you heard John's story, one of many who were happy to be living in Connecticut, to be in a state that recognized these rights for them. When we hear about Massachusetts being the first in this, again, this movement that kept growing here in Connecticut, as you got closer to November 12th. So walk us through. So it's this U.S. it was the state Supreme Court here in Connecticut that ruled first. And then how did it all come down through to November 12th? It was like a month between, right?
Yeah. And I think what's a lot of people either don't know or forget is that we had four long years where Massachusetts was the only state with marriage, and state after state had lawsuits that got that lost. And you know, we would wait on Maryland, we would wait on New Jersey, we would wait on New York, and they kept losing, losing, losing. And so we had one state with marriage and one state with civil union, and it was really significant when Connecticut added another marriage state to the winning column. We got the decision in October, and then we had the election where we had to fight off every 20 years in Connecticut. There's a question on the ballot about whether or not to open up our constitution for constitutional amendments. And we were afraid that our opponents were going to use that as a way to take away this right we had just gotten. So we had been organizing around the state to ask people to vote no on that question. And we had a resounding victory. And then 10 days later, a couple started to marry. And then we had a few more states who won the freedom to marry in the subsequent years. But I think it was very important as the second state that we kept the momentum going for the national movement.
How did it impact advocates and activists here when California Prop 8 was passed?
Yeah, so actually California was briefly the second state, and they had this little window of victory that got snatched away with the passage of Prop 8, that same election that Barack Obama was first elected president, and we defeated our constitutional question. Prop 8 was, front of mind to most people in our community, and it was devastating, and it took them a long time to come back. But sometimes bad things can raise the attention on an issue, and I think that people realized, this is not inevitable. We have to fight, and we have to speak up. And I think more people came out, more allies stood up and spoke out, and it's taken all of that to get to where we got in 2015 when the U.S. Supreme Court finally ruled in the Obergefell case that every same-sex couple in this country had the right to legally marry.
Remind us what the opponents were saying during this fight for marriage equality.
They had an evolving narrative of opposing arguments. Certainly the most common one was a religious argument that this was against the will of God. And I think one of the things that was so important for our campaign was that we, gradually got more and more clergy and people of faith standing with us so that our opponents didn't have a monopoly on religion. And so that was a very constant message that we heard. We also heard, well, this has never happened before. So, it's obviously meant never to happen in the future. One argument that our opponents used was that, every child deserved a mother and a father. And I think that the parents that came to the Capitol and talked to legislators and told their stories proved that what's important is to have loving, committed parents, and the gender was not as important as the quality of that parenting. So we were able to, dispel most of those arguments. I think that the biggest thing was that legislators were afraid. And sometimes legislators, elected officials, are leaders, and sometimes they're followers. And I think we had to get to a certain level of support in the state before more elected officials were willing to move beyond civil union to support full marriage equality.
You're listening to Where We Live. Again, we're reflecting back 10 years since same-sex marriage was legalized in the state of Connecticut. As Ann Stanback mentioned, Connecticut was the second state to legalize same-sex marriage. We want to hear from you, too. 860-275-7266. Jody's calling from New Haven. Jody, go ahead.
Hey, hi. I just want to call out to Love Makes a Family and Anne and her group. Even prior to the civil union and marriage discussion, there was a discussion around adoption of same-sex couples having children. And my partner and I have 14 years at that time, and this is back in the mid-90s, had been together for 14 years, and we had decided that we wanted to have a child together. My partner carried the child, but it was kind of unnerving to me. I had great faith in our love, but at the same time, because I did not carry the child, I had no legal right whatsoever. So God forbid anything happened, my daughter would have not been able to see me or anything else, especially after baby Z. I know that we were moving that way. And Love Makes a Family really came in, and I was one of those parents with a year-and-a-half-old daughter that did go to the legislature and, you know, stand with Love Makes a Family and listen to the arguments of why I shouldn't be a mom. So long before civil union and marriage, there was co-parent adoption, which came after my daughter was born. But if that hadn't happened, again, this decision that my partner and I had made to have a child, I wouldn't have any legal rights to my daughter whatsoever, and she could have been gone one night and never come back to see me again. You know, as gay couples, we're not anywhere, you know, above what happens in marriages of same-sex couples. And so I'm gratefully, very, very thankful for Love Makes a Family and everything that they did to protect my legal rights to a daughter that I chose to bring in this world with my partner.
Well, thank you, Jody, for sharing a little bit of your story. Anne, you want to respond?
That's really heartwarming, Jody, and I appreciate you sharing that story. And there were so many parents who had your same fears, you know, fears of what would happen if the couple broke up, but also fears if the child had an emergency, ended up in a hospital, a problem at school, and that parent would not have the right to be with that child and make decisions. So adoption was an important first step, and I think what's really heartening now is how many young people today just take that for granted, take the fact that, you know, I have so many parents who tell me that their kids are like, what? You couldn't adopt, you couldn't get married. I can't imagine a world where that wouldn't be possible. So it's nice that they think that. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Where We Live again as we reflect back 10 years since Connecticut legalized same-sex marriage. What did November 12, 2008 mean to you? You can join us 860-275-7266. Christine's calling from Southington. Christine, go ahead. Christine, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi. My wife and I had a catastrophic accident, and I couldn't put her on my insurance. And because of the accident, it's considered a pre-existing condition, we couldn't get her insurance. The only way we could get her insurance was to send her back to school for another master's and put her on the school's policy. So there were more, it was financial things. I mean, we spent thousands on insurance for her.
So this was prior to the marriage equality law in effect that you had to deal with this system that didn't recognize you and your wife as being together.
Correct.
And now that the same-sex marriage has been legalized, tell us about your life today, Christine.
She's relearning to walk. It's been 20 years, but it's been a series of surgeries and procedures and all sorts of other happy stuff, and she uses a chair at times. It's all good. We adapt.
Well, thank you, Christine. We're glad to hear that she's doing better. I wanted to turn back to the plaintiff couple in studio with us. That would be Janet Peck and Carol Conklin. They were one of the plaintiff couples that sued Connecticut for same-sex marriage. And Janet, you mentioned that you and Carol have been together for 43 years. So even before this law came onto the books, you yourself dealt with a medical issue, and Carol wasn't able to see you?
Yes, that's true. Excuse me.
I was started having health issues about 20 years into our relationship, and I was in a hospital after surgery to remove tumors from my liver. It was major life-threatening surgery, and I ended up in intensive care unit, and Carol came up to visit me, and she wasn't allowed access to my room. The nurse asked her, you know, who she was. Carol said, "I'm her partner," and that sort of didn't mean anything. And the nurse kept saying, "Well, you have to be family in order to get into intensive care." I believe Carol pulled the power of attorney, which we thought would be protect us during those times. And the nurse said, "Well, that says you can make decisions on Jana's behalf, but you still are not considered family. You can't get into her room." And I know this was very distressing time for Carol. And so all those things go away now that we're married. I've had a couple of surgeries since, and Carol's always been able to be by my side, no questions asked. And it really gives us a sense of security and peace of mind to be able to be married and not have those kind of discriminatory things happening to us anymore.
Ann Stanback, I remember after Connecticut legalized same-sex marriage, there were still fears among same-sex couples because depending on if you traveled and you happened to be in a state that didn't recognize your marriage or civil union, that it was precarious at times. And you would worry about a situation that we heard from our guests where their partners weren't able to even see them in a hospital.
That's right. We could travel to Massachusetts. We could travel to Canada. And those were about the only two places that we were safe. The Netherlands, too, I think. But we all, you know, if we were careful, we carried a big stack of papers with us and hoped that if anything, God forbid, happened, that they would protect us. I think that those stories are important to show that in times of crisis, that marriage is a legal status, and we need to be able to have the security that comes with that civil legal status. But the truth is that most same-sex couples get married for the same reasons that most heterosexual couples get. It's great to be able to get insurance. It's great to be able to visit in the hospital. But we get married because we fall in love and we want to make a life together and have that public recognition. And that's why civil union wasn't enough. That's why we needed marriage.
Before we head to break, I wanted to turn back to you, Janet. You mentioned Carol trying to assist you when you were dealing with medical issues, and now you're helping Carol as well through a health condition that has popped up since your marriage.
Yes, unfortunately, Carol's been diagnosed with the early Alzheimer's disease, which has been very difficult for us. But again, we have the peace of mind now that we have protections moving forward on this journey. If we had not been married, and at some point I know I will need help taking care of Carol, I won't be able to do it by myself. I'm going to have to pay for that care, and we are not rich people, that at some point I will need help. And without marriage, to pay for that care, we could deplete all of our savings, and our house would have to be sold to help pay for that care. Now that we're married, that can't happen. Medicaid will kick in, and we will be able to keep our home. We'll be able to keep a portion of our savings. So again, it's about that peace of mind moving forward as we go through this difficult journey. I would echo what Ann just said about getting married, too. Certainly, the rights and protections are important to us. But Carol and I wanted to get married first because we loved each other, first and foremost. We fell in love. She's the love of my life, and that's why we wanted to get married. I would also like to say to John, the first caller, that it warms my heart to hear him talk about being able to marry. Whenever I hear people that we're able to marry and have this right now, it absolutely warms my heart. I am proud to be one of the plaintiffs, and it was an honor to be one of the plaintiff couples representing so many people that wanted to marry, people that were together longer than we had been together, and also that young people now have that choice. It was an honor.
Janet Peck is here with her wife, Carol Conklin. Carol, I understand your wedding anniversary is coming up in a few months.
Not the wedding anniversary.
Yes, the wedding anniversary. January 24th.
Oh, okay.
Yep, a couple months.
Still have time to plan
I'm
that celebration.
We just had our regular anniversary.
Yes. Yeah. What happens when you're a same-sex couple is you have more than one anniversary. And our wedding anniversary, yes, is coming up in January, but we just celebrated when we first got together, which was in September. So,
well, congratulations to both of you. We appreciate you coming in to tell us your story. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Again, Janet Peck and Carol Conklin, one of the plaintiff couples in Connecticut's marriage equality case. Also here with us, Ann Stanback, a longtime activist. When we come back after the break, we're going to reflect on LGBTQ rights today and the next fight. You can join us too. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Again, today we've been reflecting back on the movement to bring marriage equality to Connecticut. One of the plaintiff couples is here with us, Janet Peck and Carol Conklin. And also with us is Ann Stanback, who was founding executive director of Love Makes a Family. This was the lead organization in Connecticut that lobbied for marriage equality. And Ann's been working on LGBTQ issues for more than 30 years. And we just have a few minutes, but I wanted to reflect back on how public opinion really changed in a matter of a couple of decades, when we think about how many Americans were opposed to the idea of same-sex marriage in 2000, but now not so much.
Now not so much. And I think that, you know, one thing I just want to say from the last segment, it really was a movement that made this possible. It wasn't one organization. I mean, nice things have been said about Love Makes a Family, and it was a wonderful grassroots movement. GLAAD, which was the legal organization that brought the Kerrigan case, was just a brilliant strategist both in Connecticut and across the country. And we wouldn't be where we are without GLAAD's work, without the work of so many organizations. I think that that movement aspect, though, is what changed public opinion. I mean, we see our country so divided now, but I think on an issue as controversial as marriage equality, that people were really afraid to come out and support, we have a more comfortable margin of public support than many other controversial issues. So I think it speaks to the importance of that public education, of having those conversations and talking one-on-one with your friends and neighbors and family.
We were talking about the movements that are important today, and one is just visibility on the rights of transgender people. Tell us about the work that's being done, Ann.
Yeah, I think that today the fight for, you know, respect and dignity and safety for transgender people and housing and employment, and the list goes on, is still one that we all need to be working on and promoting. Many people probably saw that in Massachusetts on Election Day, they overwhelmingly passed defeated a ballot question that would have taken away the rights of transgender people. They did that successfully in the same way that we successfully won the right to marry, which was they had transgender people coming out, telling their stories, and, you know, putting a human face on an issue that was very unfamiliar to a lot of people. So I think we've seen the advance and visibility of the transgender community in this last 10 years in really remarkable, wonderful ways. But there is a lot of work to do, and I think that is especially true with young, you know, transgender and gender nonconforming and gender queer kids who, you know, have a whole new language and whole new issues that they are facing in schools and in society.
When you talk about more work to be done, you know, many states are coming up with these bathroom bills, so to speak, but some states have had to walk them back, like North Carolina.
Like my home state of North Carolina. And again, in the same way that Prop 8 really made people realize, wow, there's a lot of hate out there. There's a lot of misinformation. We saw with North Carolina and with some of these bathroom bills that the fight continues, and we have not won.
Well, I want to thank Ann Stanback again, who was the founding executive director of Love Makes a Family. I understand your archives are at Yale University, all this history about the movement to bring marriage equality to the state of Connecticut. We thank you for joining us today, Ann.
Great to be here, Lucy. Thank you.
Also, Janet Peck and Carol Conklin, one of several plaintiff couples who sued the state of Connecticut for the right to marry. Thank you for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate hearing from both of you.
Thanks.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Thanks to Lydia Brown and Kyone Wolf. Learn more about the show, WMPR.org/where we live.